There's really no one like John Ronson. Some of you know him from his pieces on This American Life or his podcasts. He's a journalist. I guess you could say kind of a gonzo-like journalist who shows up in these beguiling moments of weirdness and asks the big questions underneath them. And he's got this knack for connecting it all to something larger, like what it means to be publicly shamed, what it means to be a psychopath, what it means to be an extremist. Like when he snuck into Bohemian Grove, this retreat for corporate power players, with Alex Jones. He got chased through Portugal by security for the Bilderberg Group. He tracked down this secret army unit that believes soldiers could kill goats just by staring at them. His latest book begins in an equally weird way. Here, let's just get to the story.
This story crashed unannounced into my life while I was asleep and oblivious. I awoke one morning in the summer of 2023 to discover that while I had slept, my son Joel had been texting my wife and me a series of unnerving messages about a perilous situation he had found himself in Connecticut. Given that the whole crisis had unfolded while I was asleep and completely oblivious, I saw his final text first. "We left. Was completely f***ed. All good now." So then I frantically read the other text, and it turned out that he and three friends had been invited to a party being held by a stranger that one of them had met earlier that week on Tinder. So they piled in the car and drove 3 hours from New York City and turned up at this man's house in the forests of Connecticut. But when they arrived, they found his home so bizarre. Joel did something he had never done before. He sent me the coordinates and a photograph, just in case. It was a newly built castle. Ostentatious even by Gothic castle standards. Vast number of turrets and towers and gargoyles. Like Count Dracula would have thought it was a bit much. Standing on the drawbridge were a man, a woman, and a large black guard dog with a long hooked face. The man was the castle's owner, Chris Mark. The dog was called Cerberus, named after the multi-headed hound that guards the gates of Hades. The woman was blonde and much younger than Chris Mark. Nobody caught her name, so I'll call her Amber. "And then," Joel said, "Chris Mark sort of beckoned us inside the castle." The gates open, they cross the drawbridge and enter the grand banqueting hall to discover that there's no party. It's a trick. So the castle owner comes out and they say, "Sorry, but where's the party?" And he said, "Oh no, I've invited you here for a different reason. I want you all to take part in my reality show." So they said, "What's the name of your reality show?" And he said, "It's called 101 Princesses. He said, "I'm the Lord, I'm looking for my queen, and I have 101 princesses to choose from." And then he said, "Go downstairs to my basement costume room, put on some princess costumes, and come back upstairs." So they put on the princess costumes, come back upstairs. My son and his male friend put on tuxedos. And then a videographer appears and filming begins. But it becomes pretty clear pretty quickly that this isn't a real reality show. So my son and his friends refused to participate in 101 Princesses, and the castle owner was getting more and more irritated with their non-cooperation, so he kicked them out. So they left, told me the story, and I immediately went to the castle to try and find out what was going on. And that's how the book begins.
How is it that this strange story, John, comes to be the beginning of a book? I mean, it has these various elements in it that we'll talk about, but I mean, I guess you wouldn't see these connections for a good while. So how is this the beginning, do you think?
So this coincided with me just coming out of hospital, and I was feeling this kind of sense of purposelessness, like life was slipping me by. And I was so desperate to get on a story because the sense of well-being I get from having purpose and use is just so powerful. So I went to the castle and he told me some quite unwise things about what he was doing in there, about how he attracted women and so on. He called it princessing. And some of the women I spoke to said he loves Hugh Hefner. He's trying to be Hugh Hefner. And I thought that was funny and interesting because here's a man who's trying to be Hugh Hefner at the worst moment in human history to try and be Hugh Hefner. And he actually told me that he lacked purpose. He's a man out of time. He's trying to do things that men can't do anymore. And that's turning him a little bit haywire. But a lot of people are purposeless these days. The old structures are collapsing, the institutions are collapsing, and people are being cut adrift. And I thought, okay, we're two older men who both have a slightly dysfunctional relationship with purpose, and that's what's making our lives collide. And I really wanted to explore that, what purposelessness is doing to us in this kind of post-institution age.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. John Ronson's book is called The Castle, and it isn't another disquisition about the manosphere. It's kind of wider than that. It's about a generation of men who've gone missing, out of work, out of school, out of the roles that used to give them a sense of meaning. It's about what happens to a man's sense of worth, and John includes himself in this, when the stuff that used to define them, like expertise or authority, starts working against him instead. So let's get back to the man in the castle, Chris Mark.
There was very little written about him. When word got around Woodstock, Connecticut, that the scion of a Gilded Age steel tycoon, because it turns out his great-grandfather was a Gilded Age steel tycoon, and that's where the money comes from, was building a castle on the edge of town, a couple of journalists did some digging and found some odd things. Like, for instance, in his 2010 divorce hearing, it came out that one of his pet camels had starved to death due to neglect. Yeah. And then there was talk of this odd exotic modelling agency that he briefly tried to create inside the castle, but that didn't go anywhere. And once one of the local journalists found out about it, he abandoned that plan. So it was strange. It did feel like an undiscovered story. There was the odd, I found the odd Reddit threads where people said, I went to this castle and it was very, very weird. Clearly it was an underreported story.
He started getting suspicious in your line of questioning as you're talking to him. What exactly did he think you were doing or interested in?
Well, I don't know. Like, I knew that I had to be just as rigorous as a journalist can be. So in my initial emails to him, I said, I'm a nonfiction writer. My son was invited to your castle. I'd love to come and write about it. And then I followed it up with, I'm going to bring a tape recorder. I'm going to record the conversation. So, you know, I gave him very fair warning. But I think that, and I, when we were talking, I don't know, he just, he was very indiscreet at first in a way that he later clearly regretted. He started talking about how he always thought it would be fantastic if he had six or eight girls living there. But the only girls that work in this kind of scenarios are drug addicts because they don't know what's going on. And he sort of chuckled ruefully at that. And then after a while, I noticed that he started to look a little worried about the things he'd said to me. And he suddenly stood up and went to a drawer in his kitchen and brought out an NDA and asked me to sign it. And I said, no. And he said, why? And I said, I've never signed an NDA in my life. So he put the NDA away and I noticed he had a whole pile of NDAs in a drawer. So I did think, well, who else is he getting to sign them and why?
John, where did you think this was going at this point? I mean, what was going to happen? I mean, he starts texting you, worried about what you were writing, talking about involving his team of lawyers. Like, what did you think was going to happen?
Well, actually, it was worse, though. He told me he was going to get a team of lawyers onto me and a team of international investigators, and he mentioned his friend from the FBI who wanted to meet me. So these were like texts he was firing at me. As it happens, I was driving my son from upstate New York into Manhattan at the time. So Joel was reading out these texts to me. And the mood in the car was getting more and more nervous. And then Joel read out a text that said, I'm going to be sending you some of my friends that were in prison for killing somebody. Never say anything negative about the castle or these guys will get really upset. You don't want to see them angry. Carlos and Brandon are on their way to New York now. So his two murderers were called Carlos and Brandon.
John, do you have your book in front of you by any chance?
Yeah, I've got it right over there. Will I grab it?
There's a section there that sort of is a coda to this part that I wouldn't, if you don't mind.
Sure, no. Chris Mark and I were two older men who by rights should have spent our remaining days unaware of the other's existence. But as a result of him luring a journalist's son to his mysterious castle under, at best, ambiguous circumstances, our lives had become entwined. Now, both of us were imagining the other as little short of an existential threat to our survival, poised to wipe out everything we'd built. I felt sorry to have worried him so much and hoped my reporting wouldn't affect his daughter's ambition to make the castle a wedding venue should they ever be granted a permit, which felt like a far more appropriate use of the place. His texts continued to pour in and I continued to not respond. I had by now instigated a total communication blackout. As a consequence, he was seeing me as an inscrutable menace, whereas I was seeing myself more like a rabbit in broad daylight, reacting to danger by standing completely still. He was lashing out while I was shutting down, and mine was proving the more successful response, given how he was filling my silence with texts that would sound horrifying if read out in court.
When you look across the different people and stories in the book, what do you figure is the larger condition you're interested in exploring? I mean, I guess it's masculinity in a way, but I also wondered if it was masculinity because it gets at this broader question of what it means to live also in just contemporary social and in the political environment as a man. I guess it's what is the condition, I think, that you're really getting at, do you think?
I think it's this idea of how so many of the structures that everybody, and I'm focusing on men in this book, but some of the structures that everybody used to live in were, even if they were bad ones, even if we didn't like them, even if they were corrupt institutions that would harm people, there's something odd about the fact that when you kind of drift from those old structures, it does something to you. It sends you, and the picture, the kind of mental image I have is of an astronaut cutting the cord, you know, having the cord cut to the spaceship and then just, you know, tumbling slowly into the blackness of space. I think a lot of people are tumbling into the blackness of space right now. And it's to do with the fact that all the society's rules have changed. And they've changed for everybody, I think, in terms of work. Mm. So there's that. But then there's also, I think, the maleness side of it, which is a lot of men are feeling sort of tossed around in a sea of conflicting ideologies about what being a man actually means. And so I go there in the book as well and tell funny stories about when men being vulnerable goes wrong and how men are portrayed in TV ads and so on. So I guess it's the two things are working concurrently to make men feel just like they don't know who they are anymore. They don't know what they're doing. And what is that lack of purpose doing to them and to their loved ones and to society?
John Ronson. We're talking about his new book. It's called The Castle, Adventures in a World of Unraveling Men. We'll take a break. Come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. The writer John Ronson is with us today. His new book started with this cryptic text from his son. He and a friend had been lured into an actual castle in Connecticut where a man had them playing dress up in this really weird role-playing ritual. So that's how it started. and it sent Ronson down this rabbit hole into a world of men who seemed to be coming unglued. Men who are chasing purpose and control in a world that feels like it's shifting under them. The book is called, of course, The Castle. One of the things you say in the book is that men are resourceful, and that men have these ways of, this is how you put it, dreaming up these positive new ways to thrive in this new world. And one of these, of course, is YouTube videos. And that gets us to Greg Chisholm. To tell us where Greg Chisholm fits. So Greg, I guess with Greg, you're interested in what happens to this really ordinary person and his identity that starts becoming shaped by, I guess, by the attention of the internet, I suppose.
Yeah, the algorithms and also the viewers.
Right.
Greg's story is a stunning story. So he comes from a dying Rust Belt town. He should have gone to work in the factory that his father worked in, but the factory shut down and moved to Mexico, and his whole town, Granite City, Illinois, collapsed. At the age of 17, Greg is working at Taco Bell, where he can feel his heart racing. He collapses unconscious and has a very serious, potentially lethal heart condition, which means he has to have multiple open heart surgeries. So at the age of 18, he's got no prospects and he owes the health insurance companies $200,000. Then things get even worse. He meets somebody, they fall in love, they marry, they have a child, but they split up and she leaves him with two children. So he's a single father of two children, owing all of this money and with no prospects. So then he has his Damascus moment. He's on YouTube and this is in the early days of YouTube.
Yeah.
And some guy who's riding a bicycle, a guy called Harley Johnston, riding a bicycle through Australia. He pulls up, he goes, you know, I won't do an Australian accent. I used to be in prison. I've lived on the streets, but look at me now. I'm here making a YouTube video. You could do that. You can make a YouTube video. And Greg just found his calling. So he became a YouTuber. So his first YouTube series was his adult braces journey. His teeth overlapped quite significantly because he didn't have any money to get them fixed when he was a kid. So he took out a $6,000 line of credit, got adult braces and documented his adult braces journey. Then people started saying to him, why have you got lawnmowers behind you? And Greg says, I do lawn care. And they're like, you do lawn care, do a lawn care vlog.
Yeah.
And Greg's like, who's interested in a lawn care vlog? And they're going, bro, do a lawn care vlog. So Greg makes a video called A Day in the Life of a Lawn Care Provider. And he shoots to fame in the lawn care world. He gets 100,000 views a week. He would do Good Samaritan lawn work. He'll jump out of his truck, mow somebody's lawn, and then jump back into the truck and vanish again like the Zorro of lawn care chores. And he was doing fantastically. And this is a real high point in Greg's life. He goes to a lawn care convention in Kentucky where there's a meet and greet organized for him and he's mobbed with fans. And then everything starts to go wrong.
Yeah. Well, before we get there, I want to just ask you about this moment because you talk about this in the book where people are taking their chances as influencers and content creators. What do you make of that? Does it even seem sustainable?
Yeah. I mean, at the beginning and theoretically, I could see the value in this. I've always believed in egalitarianism and I always hated gatekeepers. But it turns out that being a content creator could send you into some very dark places. And that's what we're seeing. And I tell a couple of those stories in the book. And the reason why it sends you into dark places is because you lose your agency to the incentive structure of these platforms, whether it's the algorithms or whether it's the viewer comments. You become... Do you remember that old novel, The Dice Man? It was a guy, it was a novel when I was growing up. A guy decides to cede his free will to the roll of the dice. And I think that's what we're seeing on YouTube, but people are ceding their free will to what they think the internet wants them to be.
Well, without, I guess, giving up too much, Greg is determined to maximize the search engine of optimization, and so he keeps coming up with increasingly novel ideas, and it becomes something of a disaster. Starts involving his daughters, and I don't know how much you want to say about it, but it's
actually pretty good for people to just let it unfold, actually.
Well, let's talk about the phenomenon then, because I think that you mentioned this British writer and technology thinker, James Bridle, who wrote this essay that you referred to in the book, Something is Wrong with the Internet. He wrote it a couple of years ago. And he's sort of looking at these, I guess when these YouTube videos involve certain things go badly and how they work and how the system works in this like feedback loop. Do you mind saying something about the way this works?
Well, okay. So he said in the world of algorithmic discovery, people have to ape the machine. So the way a lot of these YouTube videos are evolving is that the algorithm will sort of spit out a word salad of meaningless words. Bad baby, bloody nose, Elsa, Spider-Man. And then human beings have to make it work. It is kind of difficult to explain without explaining exactly what the thing is.
Well, let's just say that with Greg, the videos get stranger.
Stranger and stranger, more and more extreme and odd.
Yeah.
And it's because he has ceded his life to the algorithm and to what the viewers want him to be. He's given all of his free will to the algorithm, and it takes him into a place that really ruins his life.
I mean, the algorithm is rewarding escalation. And it seems like what Bridle is saying is he's like taking this conceptual leap that the content you end up with doesn't have anything to do with where you started, like with your intention, but you just give way to it, I guess, over time.
Exactly. YouTube presents itself as this kind of hierarchy-free, gatekeeper-free, post-institution utopia where anyone can make it a level playing field. But actually, you start working for the machine, where even if you're not aware that you're doing it, you're working for this word salad of algorithmic. Let me give you an example from a previous show I made. I made a show called The Butterfly Effect about the consequences of the tech takeover of the porn industry. This is a really good way of describing it. So one day I was on the set of a porn film. This was for Audible, set of a porn film called Stepdaughter Cheerleader Orgy. And the director, Mike Quasar, lamented to me the utilitarian nature of the film's title. He said, when I started out in porn in the 90s, my films had this kind of, you know, more interesting sort of quasi-soody titles like Women of Influence or Playing with Fire. But now they're called Stepdaughter Cheerleader Orgy. And I said, why? And he said, well, search engine optimization. You just need to find the most searched for keywords and call your film that and then get the actors to do that. So you're completely enslaved to search engine optimization. He said, hence, stepdaughter, cheerleader, and orgy. They're three of the most searched for terms. So that day he was shooting stepdaughters who are also cheerleaders and also they're having an orgy. So I said to him, are there any women in porn who can't get work anymore because they don't fall under any search term? And he said, yes, if you're a 23-year-old woman in porn now, you can't get work because you're too old to be a teen and you're too young to be a MILF. You're just in this sort of hinterland between teen and MILF. So that's a good example of what happens when we allow search engine optimization to control our lives too much.
John, I wanted to ask you what it's like as a man talking about what it means to be a man, like how strange that might be. You write about this moment on the Australian broadcasting, this Australian broadcasting program a few years ago where you said it was a strange time to be a man. And then things just sort of froze for a minute. What happened?
Absolutely. Yeah, it was. I did have that sort of unease. So at the very beginning of me thinking about I'm going to write this book, I was in Australia doing a speaking tour for my psychopath test book. And I went on a current affairs show called Q&A. And there was a question about maleness. And I just, I hadn't formulated my thoughts at all. I just thought I'll say this to hear how it sounds out loud. I said, it's a strange time to be a man. And the presenter spun around and said, is it? Why? And it was like by far the testiest moment in the show. So I quickly blurted something out about working class men in Rust Belt towns. Everybody relaxed. But it did make me realise that there's a huge pitfall here to writing a kind of book like this. I was being interviewed by Charlie Wazell at The Atlantic the other day, and he said to me, what do you say to somebody who's walking down the book aisle and sees your book and thinks, oh, another book, you know, a book about masculinity. Yeah. I don't want to read that. Mm. And I said, yeah, I would be that person. Mm. I have no interest in reading a kind of polemic about masculinity. But this book is just a million miles from that, both in terms of how it reads and what it's about. Mm. It's a kind of propulsive, page-turning, gripping mystery story, which I think takes you to these, like, you know, new and interesting things to think about, which are the things we've been talking about on the show. But yeah, I was. I remember I met Richard Reeves, who wrote Of Boys and Men, and he warned me. He said, you know, people get the wrong idea. He said that, you know, he'd had to dispel the myth that he was a kind of manosphere wolf in academics' clothing, that anybody who talks about men has somehow got some weird agenda.
Are you feeling bummed out that people are talking about the manosphere so much these days?
I guess I'm a little bit sort of reluctantly at peace with it, thinking, oh, God, if people are going to do that, then I might as well just go with it and not, you know, get annoyed. But I do think my first thought when I decided to write this book was, whenever I start a big project, I always think, what's the worst version of this story? Because then you know what to try and avoid.
Yeah.
And I thought, well, the worst version of this story is the manosphere and incels, these sort of fringy, you know, in the same way, in my book, so you've been publicly shamed about people being caught up in shaming campaigns online. I wasn't writing about Rupert Murdoch. I was writing about some random person with 100 Twitter followers, just an ordinary person whose life gets pulled into these currents, you know, that they have nothing to do with. And I wanted to do the same thing here. I wanted it to be about ordinary men. And if I don't do the manosphere, if I don't do incels, it forces me to go to more interesting places.
You do write about this person, Dan Bilzerian. People may know who he is. He sort of, I guess he finds his identity in this super hyper masculine spectacle. You don't spend a lot of time with him, but I did want to ask. I mean, it seems like what you're interested in is what happens when, I don't know, I guess masculinity becomes something that has to be performed so publicly. Wealth and sex and danger and stuff like that. Is that what interested you about him?
Yes. I realize that a lot of the men in this book were living fake lives. You had my castle owner with his fake reality show and his fake party. Plus, he'd give women who visited him jewelry as gifts. Then he'd get home and realize it was fake jewelry. Plus, he would boast about how the Prince of Mongolia would come and visit the castle, but it turned out to be a fake Prince of Mongolia. Yeah. So that whole everything happening inside that castle is fake. But then you've also got these anti-woke influencers who I interview in the book, who admit to me that they don't even mean it. They don't even mean it. It's just the they make money when they book the most extreme people out there, and they don't make money when they book people like me. But if you're completely, you know, if you say the most horrific things you can think of, if you're all eared, you like pull off your face and let your eared run wild, everyone watches. So, yeah, you've got all of these men who are like building their houses on sand. And Dan Bilzerian was really interesting to me because he would go on Joe Rogan and boast about all the sex he has and how he once won $54 million in a poker game and so on. He's got a big brags. Turns out he's a trust. I mean, he may well have made money in poker, but he's also a trust fund kid.
Yeah.
What's interesting about Dan Bilzerian? Well, lots of things are, but one is that he was at a concert in Las Vegas when that man in the Mandalay Bay Hotel opened fire and killed 60 people. So Dan Bilzerian is suddenly in the midst of a real-life mass shooting where no amount of braggadocio or fakery would work. This was real life. And he clearly realized that this was a chance for him to prove that he wasn't fake. He was a real, he was a man in full. And so what did he do? He went into the crime scene. There's a dead body lying underneath a sheet. And he and this friend of his pick up this dead body. And the police officer's like, whoa, whoa. You know, recognised him. Mr. Bilzerian, sir, what are you doing? And he said, we've got to get this guy to the hospital. So Dan Bilzerian was so intent on proving that he was real. He was prepared to disturb a crime scene, disturb a corpse, and put himself in danger to try and take a dead body for treatment in a hospital.
You say that you think the appeal of guys like Bilzerian is, and this is how you put it in the book, is a reaction to initiatives in the 2010s that had been intended to guide boys toward healthier places, but instead had proved too draconian or disparaging. And it gets us to the story you write about the school in Australia. And I wanted you to say a little bit more about this, because this complicates the story, I think, in some way.
Yeah. School in a working class suburb near Melbourne. The headmaster, school principal, gets all the kids into school to stand up in the assembly hall and instructed the boys to turn, each of them to turn to a girl and apologize to them for rape, for the concept of rape. So I spoke to one of the boys and I said, like, did they do it? And he said, yeah. And I said, what do they say? And he said, just, he just heard, like, you know, hundreds of boys sort of just muttering, you know, sorry for rape. And I said, and he didn't do it. He refused. And it was a disaster. The girl started crying. The boys were upset. Why were we being asked to do something, to apologize for something that we hadn't done? And the girls were like, why are we being forced? You know, why were boys apologizing us for something that hasn't happened to us? Mm. The girls were crying. The headmaster lost all respect and status in the school. Nobody would listen to him anymore. He ended up moving to a different school. And I think that, you know, that's a kind of extreme example of how a well-meaning initiative can force boys, not force boys, but could have, you know, make boys sort of, you know, make the pendulum swing in the wrong direction, and boys will end up aspiring to be like Dan Bilzerian.
John Ronson, we're talking about his new book. It's called The Castle, Adventures in a World of Unraveling Men. We'll take another break, come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Let's get back to our conversation with the journalist and writer John Ronson. We're talking about his latest book. It's called The Castle, Adventures in a World of Unraveling Men. There's a part of the book when you kind of reflect on your own level of masculinity and the kind of, you know, these sort of traits, stoicism and dominance and, you know, risk. And you said you used a lot of them in the book.
I know. This really made me laugh. So the American Psychological Association brought out a paper a couple of years ago where they said that traditional masculinity was on the whole harmful, and then listed harmful male traits.
Yeah.
And some of them were clearly harmful, like misogyny. But there was a few in there that I do all the time. Risk, adventure, competitiveness. It was achievement one. I think achievement might have been what it was. You know, I don't know about you, but I think, well, I like to achieve things, especially if it puts me in a risky situation. And competitiveness, sure, I want to be better than every other nonfiction writer. Anyway, so I got kind of irritated by this thing. And I thought, you know, I don't identify the slightest as masculine. So if this is annoying me, how much must it be annoying, you know, more masculine men? But then I realized I'm pulling myself out of my sick bed days after having major surgery to like get myself into a car and drive to a castle. So my hard-won realization was, you know what? I think they were onto something. Their choice of words could have been an awful lot better, but I think they were onto something.
There's this part of the book where you explore the vulnerable man, which you say sort of appears as a character in advertising during World War I. Say something about that.
Well, I'd noticed after Me Too that suddenly my Instagram feed was awash with men's health influencers taking a leaf out of Brené Brown's book and saying that the way for men to re-anchor themselves to a society that's growing more feminized is be vulnerable, get rid of your manly masks and allow your vulnerabilities to shine through, and women love it, they appreciate it. But then all of these people would, and I've noticed it myself, and these other men would report that, you know, they would dutifully try it out. So they'd be on a date and be vulnerable. And they'd see the women recoil in disgust. And Brené Brown herself says the same thing. She says, we beg men to open up and be vulnerable. But when they try it, we recoil in horror. So I got really interested in that and the idea of all these like differing ideologies about how a man should survive in this new world.
You mentioned it was a couple of years ago when this national research group, this Hollywood market research firm, they asked, it was like 700 young men and boys these questions, like, what is it that they would want to see in a superhero? But then what would they want to see in themselves? Like they seemed like really interesting kinds of questions. What did you learn about that? I thought that was really interesting.
I thought it's interesting. So basically, they asked boys and girls to list the positive male for boys and female for girls role models, their favorite positive role models in movies and TV shows, and the girls were like, the woman from Legally Blonde,
Black Widow, Wonder Woman.
Yeah, but also some sort of real women in real world situations, like some cop shows and so on.
Meredith Grey and Grey's Anatomy.
Whereas the boys' list was all superheroes. It was just superheroes. And SpongeBob, but I think SpongeBob is a kind of superhero. But the point of the report was that Hollywood is not giving young boys positive role models of men in just sort of real world, navigating real world situations.
Mm. I guess the takeaway I got from that story also is that basically men are looking elsewhere for cues for being masculine. And it seems like
the internet.
Yeah, exactly. And that's kind of what you're getting at. I mean, it seems like where you landed in some way was that these men are moving through, this is how you put it in the book, their lives in a very different way. And you say they're like separatists, that they're creating these worlds where they don't have to interact with anyone outside of being on their absolute own terms, their own world they build, I guess.
Yeah, yes. And obviously one example of that is my castle owner. But a more personal to me example of that is I've had a very painful chapter in the book about an old friend of mine called Graham Linehan, who is a brilliant comedy writer. He was a showrunner on a show called Father Ted, which was a hugely influential, beloved show, and a show called The IT Crowd. Anyway, he which was also very beloved. Mm-hmm. And he got involved in the gender critical movement and lost himself in it so much, doubled down and doubled down and doubled down, and just became, and is to this day, unbelievably disinhibited. He will act however he wants. It's like he's, I say in the book, it's like he's ripped off his face and just allowed his id to run wild. And unfortunately, I'm one of his bete noirs. Mm. He's taken against me and posted about me thousands of times. And so I wanted to write about our relationship and how it all went wrong in the book to look at that type of man who has responded to all of these societal changes by by just being entirely disinhibited, just behaving entirely how they want to. In fact, the opposite of what I wrote about him, say, you've been publicly shamed, where everybody was being like shamed into acquiescence. Mm. That clearly stopped working. And now people are just becoming like unashamed and disinhibited.
Yeah, that was a sad part of the book, I have to say. The relationship and what happened and the way you processed that.
It's very, very sad. He's doing it today as we speak. He's discovered he's in my book. And
I imagine.
And I'm staying away from X. Luckily, X is his own real platform now, and that's become a sort of weird place where most people don't go on anymore. So I don't feel quite as bad. I've deleted the app from my phone. But if I did go on to X right now, it would be just hundreds of messages about how vile I am. All because, by the way, I told Graham I thought he was acting like a bully. That's what made the gates of hell open on me.
There are moments in the story, and there's one particular moment where you're running down this angle in the Chris Mark story on Nantucket Island, and you basically rushed out the door from home to get there, basically on your wedding anniversary. When you kind of stop for a minute and wonder, like, why am I doing this?
Why? On my wedding anniversary. I don't put this in the book, but I spent my 40th birthday in West Virginia with a church minister who helps non-terminally ill people commit suicide. He's like, if people remember the movie Vera Drake, he's like the Vera Drake of assisted suicide. He'll help anyone, even if they're just a little bit, depressed that day, because he thinks it'll get them to heaven quicker. That's how I spent my 40th with him in West Virginia. So it definitely gave me pause, and I've just completely ceded my life. If I'm going to write about unraveling men, I had to write about my own unraveling. It's my kind of, I once asked Randy Newman when I was interviewing him, why do you write songs? And he said, it's how I judge myself and how I feel better. And that's why I do what I do. It's how I judge myself and how I feel better.
It gives me a chance to have you read another section from the book, if you don't mind.
Sure. But what did I sacrifice for this lifelong monk-like devotion to work? Friendships, for sure. Why did I so rarely loosen my grip on being a useful man, a provider, and just enjoy some ordinary fun? I remember that American Psychological Association list of harmful male traits, competitiveness, risk, achievement, and felt annoyed by that list when I first heard about it. Wanting to achieve things wasn't harmful, it was good. But maybe they'd been onto something. I was, after all, standing alone on a beach road in Nantucket, staring into a probably empty mansion on my wedding anniversary, all because I couldn't bear having no purpose in my life. Everyone I met for this book had, I thought, a similarly dysfunctional relationship with purpose, hunting too desperately for it. And now there was a generation of men, unanchored from society and going it alone, as content creators, culture war influencers, amateur sleuths. There was even a dark part of me that felt happy, even relieved, that Joel hadn't turned around when he got to the castle gates that night. The very tangible danger he'd been put into had, after all, given me something to do.
One of the things you mentioned at the end of the book that I wanted to ask you about is you kind of go further than saying just online masculinity has become, radicalized or whatever, but that you kind of make the connection, as I see it, between that and what I guess is kind of the exercise of state power, like with Donald Trump and ICE and the crackdown of the immigration movement. And you write about how the politicization of this broken kind of masculinity now felt like government policy. And I found that really interesting. What are you getting at there?
Yeah. Well, so as I mentioned briefly, the castle owner I discovered was being investigated for some serious crimes by the Department of Homeland Security. But hasn't been arrested and may never be arrested. Yeah. Apparently he's out of the country right now. But I was looking into the possibility that maybe the investigation into him had died down because of something that had changed within the Department of Homeland Security, which is that I think a lot of people don't know the difference between these different bodies within the department. So Homeland Security Investigations is this really serious, well-trained group of like earnest investigators who are investigating sex trafficking and drug smuggling and money laundering and child pornography, cross-border crime. And all over America, those investigators were being pulled off their cases to assist ICE in rounding up 3,000 undocumented immigrants a day. So if, when you look at the footage in places like Minneapolis, it's not only ICE who are rounding up these, you know, gardeners and construction workers. It's these serious investigators, Homeland Security Investigations. And so that was, and obviously they hate it. They want to be out doing the stuff that they do. As one of them said to me, it's like pulling a homicide detective off a murder case to give parking violations. And who are these people, these ICE officers, who these, you know, serious investigators are being compelled to drop everything to assist? Well, ICE recruitment has gone from 21 to 18. They're advertising at UFC games and so on. And the tenor of the ads are basically, are you sick of this feminized society? Come to us, be David's battling the Goliath of wokeism. So yeah, this broken kind of masculinity is now government policy. Mm.
Let me ask you finally, it's kind of a obvious question. Where do you think this is headed? I mean, have you, in working through this book and the stories in the book, have you detected a trajectory in any way?
Yeah. And you know what? I think I'm going to put this in the paperback. So I mentioned the UFC just now because that's where ICE, you know, did some of their recruitments. I don't put this in the book and it's not been published yet. But I went to the cage fight at the White House.
Wow.
On the South. Yeah. Oh, God, what a wild week. My American publisher insisted I did it. I was so exhausted. I'd just finished the book. And he said, no, you've got to do it. And I said, well, I'm only going to do it if I get access to the South Lawn, thinking this is the perfect crime. I'll never get access to the South Lawn. And I got access to the South Lawn. So I ran it for GQ. But I'm so glad I did it. It was a wild week. And I want to end with a positive story that I learned that day. Now, this is anecdotal. And every time I have any kind of positive prognosis for the future, it always turns out to not be true. Things only ever seem to get worse. But here's a little positive moment. So I was chatting with a fighter, a UFC fighter called Sean O'Malley, who's a little bit of a UFC heartthrob. And he would often boast in podcast interviews about his open marriage. Now, it was a one-sided open marriage. He was allowed to have sex with other women, but his wife, Dania, wasn't allowed to have sex with other men. And the way he would explain it on podcasts was, it's status. He said, Andrew Tate puts it well, I have status, it's status. So I said to him, you have an open marriage, surely that doesn't work. And he said, well, it worked until it didn't. And he revealed to me that his wife has put her foot down and he's no longer allowed to have sex with other women. It's no longer an open marriage. And he looked so baffled by this change in his fortunes. And it did make me wonder whether... And in fact, I noticed a couple of other things that week where I noticed men being... It sort of snapped back into place a little bit. Like, you can't just be this maverick who just whatever they like and it's my way or the highway. Things are, and it just made me wonder whether the failure of Sean O'Malley's open marriage might be an indication that the pendulum is swinging back again a little bit and we're reaching some middle ground equanimity.
John Ronson, thank you very much.
Dirk, that was a total pleasure. Thank you.
John Ronson, his book is The Castle, Adventures in a World of Unraveling Men. Radio West is a production of KUER. You can subscribe to the show wherever you get your podcasts. We're on Instagram at Radio West. We're on YouTube at KUER90.1. You can email us at radiowest@kuer.org. Aidan Oneida is our social media producer. Our intern is Jill Tuft. The program produced by Tim Slover. I'm Doug Fabrizio.